This is WMRA's Second Look.
Mandatory reporting is a well-meaning concept. It takes the control away from survivors from being able to decide whether or not to make that report themselves.
That's Kate McCord of the Virginia Sexual and Domestic Violence Action Alliance reacting to proposals in this session of the General Assembly to require colleges in the state to report sexual assaults to law enforcement. Andrew Jenner had that report from Richmond, and he also introduced us to a fascinating new exhibit of photographs in Harrisonburg. We've got those reports. Plus, our Kara Lofton was busy this week attending last weekend's visit to EMU by Nobel Peace Laureate Lema Bowie to help raise money for Ebola treatment in West Africa. Kara also produced a two-part report with some advice on how you can do a better job of protecting your identity and your personal data. It's time for Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from the WMRA newsroom this week. Let's get started. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Last weekend, Nobel Peace Laureate Lema Bowie visited her alma mater, Eastern Mennonite University, to support an Ebola fundraiser organized by EMU's International Student Organization. WMRA's Kara Lofton was there for this story.
Lema Bowie spoke twice Saturday night at Eastern Mennonite University, first during the fundraising dinner, and then again immediately after to a crowd of students and community members in the university auditorium. In addition to being one of the three African countries hit hardest by the Ebola outbreak, Liberia is recovering from a brutal civil war. Much of Bowie's peace-building efforts during and after the war have centered around mobilizing women and young people to rebuild society at the local level. She said these mobilization tactics have proved translatable to fighting the Ebola virus. Before foreign government experts came to Liberia, a term she used with some derision, local communities had already done much of the groundwork.
Initially, when the virus started, because there was a lot of mistrust and distrust, people versus government, and a lot of anger at the unnecessary death of pregnant women, young children, we were afraid that it would slip into riots and eventually lead into conflict. But community peoples, especially women, were very quick to mobilize. And once community people saw again that there were people who were stepping up, speaking up, and doing things to show that they care, some of the anger went down and it helped.
The beauty in all of this, she said, is that communities did not wait for the West to come and save them.
We are of the opinion, especially me, coming from a grassroots background, that it's only the people who understand their context and understand their issue can actually make impact. So we've raised close to $350,000 to give to these little groups who would not necessarily receive money from the traditional donors. So that has been my part in the fight, using my voice globally to talk about the effect of Ebola, using my voice to talk about what local people are doing, and then using the contacts that I have to help raise money and bring visibility to the work that we do.
She said she came to EMU because the students in the International Student Organization asked her to, and a big part of her mission is to support the efforts of young people. Winifred Johnson is the student who originally had the idea for a fundraiser. Johnson is a sophomore from Liberia who wasn't able to go home between her freshman and sophomore years because of the virus. She said that the idea for the fundraiser came to her because she felt helpless and wanted to do something to support people back home. Bowie came to the fundraiser at no cost to the university, including plane tickets, hotel rooms, and other transportation. This will allow the International Student Organization to donate the maximum amount of profits to communities in Liberia.
Our goal is that we are able to help children who have become victims of the disease, who have lost parents, and who are now in like shelter homes or whatever. So that's our goal. And we're also just trying to raise awareness. And the thing is, you have to get people out there in the field to talk to local Liberians who are not as educated. So hopefully, whatever it is that we get can go for two reasons, really. Help with these orphans and just help to spread the word.
I want us to think about this question, Bowie said during her public address. Why should we care? Why should I care about Africa? If you think today you are going to sneeze in Virginia, and you think it is just a sneeze, you are wrong. Today, you sneeze in Virginia, and someone will get a cold in Kenya. It, Ebola, is a global problem. For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
That report from Harrisonburg, and now to Richmond, where the problem of campus sexual assault got some attention in the General Assembly. As WMRA's Andrew Jenner reports, the proposals are not without controversy.
By the time the General Assembly convened this year, key details in the now infamous Rolling Stone article about a rape and subsequent cover-up at the University of Virginia had been discredited. The larger and all-too-real problem of sexual assault on college campuses, however, remains high on many legislators' priority lists.
What we're trying to address would be when and how a college administrator should make report when he has evidence that a violent crime has been committed on college campuses.
Delegate Rob Bell is a Republican whose district lies to the north and east of Charlottesville. He's introduced one of several controversial mandatory reporting bills now before the legislature.
My view is that there are certainly many things that colleges can handle adequately, but there does reach a point where the offense is so violent and so serious that it really is more appropriately addressed through the criminal justice system.
In broad terms, Bell's bill would require faculty and administrators to notify law enforcement any time they learn that a violent sexual crime may have been committed against a student. There are some complications with federal law, so some of these reports would be made through another university official.
Mandatory reporting is a well-meaning concept. Our concerns with it are that it takes the control away from survivors from being able to decide whether or not to make that report themselves.
Kate McCord is communications director with the Virginia Sexual and Domestic Violence Action Alliance. The group promotes trauma-informed responses to victims of sexual violence.
That includes allowing survivors their own agency in determining where their case goes, having confidential advisors on campus and off campus. We're advocating for an option of anonymous reporting for victims or survivors and mandatory training for investigators.
Until the criminal justice system responds more sensitively to victims' needs, she says, mandatory reporting laws could decrease reporting by victims who fear being re-victimized by the process. At the same time, Bell says colleges have to weigh two different victims' needs.
The first would be, of course, the victim of the crime itself, the survivor of what happened. And the second would be, since there's often a reoffense problem, you have the next victim. And trying to balance those is one of the more complicated issues in criminal law. This is not unique to sexual assault, it's not unique to campuses, but you have a person in front of you who has been victimized by a crime, and you're afraid that if you don't get the guy that did it, that 6 weeks, 6 months later, someone else will walk through the door with the same offense.
His bill would require colleges to make advocates trained in trauma-informed response available to victims. It passed committee last week and is now before the full House of Delegates for a vote. Another similar reporting bill has also made it to the House floor. And in the Senate, a mandatory reporting bill passed a committee vote this week. In all, McCord says, the General Assembly is paying an unprecedented level of attention to campus sexual assault.
It is fundamentally a very positive move in the right direction, absolutely. And the spirit of mandatory reporting policies is that sexual assault should be taken seriously because it is a crime. So we understand and acknowledge and appreciate that as part of these bills that are going through the General Assembly.
As always, the details are the tricky part.
I think people understand that this is a difficult issue and a complicated issue, and we're trying to find a way to make, again, our colleges safer for the crime victim that's right in front of us, but also try to prevent further victims in the future.
And the best way to do that, McCord says, is to get at the very root of the problem.
What truly works is real prevention, is teaching about what consent looks like and how to practice consent. It's about teaching bystanders how to step in and say something.
For WMRA News, I'm Andrew Jenner.
Another issue much in the news lately is cybersecurity and the latest big hack this month on health insurance giant Anthem. Kara Lofton filed a two-part report with some advice for how to protect your identity and data online.
Data theft is really all about the money. If someone can steal your personal information, then they can use it to either steal from you personally or to sell your identity to someone else who might want to use your identity for some reason or another. So how do you keep your information safe? It sounds simple, but personal data security all starts with a password. Not 1234 or the word password for your password, but a real, complex, hard-to-guess combination of letters, characters, and digits that have nothing to do with your favorite baseball team or childhood pet. Jack Davidson is a professor of computer science at the University of Virginia.
You see these things now that banks and companies actually force you to pick a password that has, you know, letters and digits and special characters in it that have to be a certain length so that it makes it hard to guess.
In addition to requiring more complex passwords, companies are beginning to offer a service called two-factor authentication, which Davidson says consumers should take advantage of whenever possible. Two-factor authentication basically means an additional step to verify you are who you say you are before you can access your account. An example is being required to answer a security question after inputting your username and password. This process takes a little longer than single-factor authentication, but is much more secure. But common security questions can be things like, what is your mother's maiden name? Or, in what city did you grow up? In a world where people share minute details of their lives on social media, the answers to these questions can be easy to find.
For anything, there's a good side and a bad side. And I think that for a lot of people, they are sharing too much.
Says Edna Reed, a professor of intelligence analysis at James Madison University.
So you can actually create a pattern of life analysis on people based upon what they share on social media. I can identify your family, where you work, you know, what time do you normally get to work, what devices do you have, what are your hobbies, who do you socialize with?
She says the point is not to go and delete your Facebook and Twitter accounts, but rather to be selective about how detailed the information is that you share. Saying you went out to eat with friends is okay. Announcing your location every 2 hours for weeks on end is probably not advisable. In addition to using complex passwords and refraining from oversharing, Reed said the biggest thing consumers should be aware of is phishing emails. Phishing emails may look completely legitimate and appear to come from sources like your bank or your place of work, but the information they ask for is a little off.
As a consumer, I have to be very suspicious now about the emails that I receive because some of the emails will look very authentic. But then you have to do the research on the link. You know, does this link look like a credible link?
A suspicious email might ask for your password or your social security number. It might also include a link to click here and check your bank account because it claims you have been hacked. In those cases, instead of clicking through the link, she says to type the URL of the company website into your browser instead of following what might end up being a bad link, which exists in a variety of different forms.
One thing that they might do is to use that vulnerability to download software onto your machine that could then, you know, watch, you know, what you type on your computer and send it back to them. This is called a keylogger. And so they would install a keylogger on your machine, and every keystroke that you typed in the machine would be sent back to them. And what they're hoping that you will do is at some point go to a bank site, log in, enter your, you know, password, your account number, or whatever, and then now they have access, you know, to your bank account.
In reality, cybersecurity is a little overwhelming because hackers are becoming more sophisticated. We have so many devices, and the presence of flaws or vulnerabilities in the software are an inevitable part of developing technology. However, being proactive by doing things like using malware protection software, making sure all of your devices have passwords, and developing a healthy sense of skepticism can make the difference between remaining a consumer and becoming a victim. For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
And the second report from Kara Lofton on the broader problem faced by businesses and governments.
Warfare is no longer relegated to a battlefield of guns and bombs, but has expanded to include malicious attacks via keystroke. As 1984 as this might sound, the reality is that recent hacks into mega companies such as Anthem, Sony, Target, and Home Depot were all cybercrimes of increasing sophistication and breadth. In this world, where data is synonymous with money, Homeland Security is not just protecting homes and families, but protecting people's identity. Jack Davidson is a professor of computer science at the University of Virginia. He is also president of Zephyr Software, a company that does research and development on cybersecurity for the U.S. government. He said that for both personal and corporate attacks,
the real answer to everything, it's all about the money. You know, what they're trying to do there is gain personal information, social security numbers, maybe if there's bank account information, so that they can do identity theft. But really the bottom line is they're trying to steal money from individuals by stealing their identity, and then they can, you know, run up credit card debt.
Any software program inevitably has vulnerabilities, but it is not always clear where vulnerabilities are until they get attacked. So in the programming world, there is a simultaneous dance of programmers trying to find and fix vulnerabilities while hackers are trying to find and exploit them.
One of the problems is that software has become so complex that it's almost impossible to build without having some kind of what we call bugs or flaws in it. And these flaws can be exploited by malicious people. So one of the things that the government is trying to do is to find these flaws or bugs before the software gets deployed out there and being used and then can be hacked.
In technology, there is constantly a tension between usability, affordability, and security. As more and more companies are hacked, though, security is beginning to be prioritized.
In 2014, we had a lot of hacks in the retail industry. Well, that's because a lot of the companies in the retail industry were not encrypting the data. We call them soft targets.
Edna Reed is a former FBI consultant and teaches intelligence analysis at James Madison University.
So if you're looking at network security, if I don't think I'm going to be hacked, I'm not going to go through the extra expense and steps of encrypting my data. But you look at places like law enforcement, healthcare, they should be actively encrypting their data. Law enforcement organizations do that, but we found historically that healthcare organizations haven't been doing that.
Encryption is simply a way of coding data so that it can only be read with the correct key or program. One healthcare organization that did not encrypt their data is the insurance giant Anthem, whose breach earlier this month affected 80 million Americans, including both Reed and Davidson. As Reed mentioned earlier, healthcare and retail organizations are not required to encrypt their data, although they are strongly encouraged to do so. While encryption can certainly provide some protection for companies' vulnerabilities, it will not protect companies if employee credentials have been compromised through phishing campaigns, as was the case with the 2015 attack on Anthem. Anthem is now saying that they believe at least 5 employee credentials were compromised prior to the attack. For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
We also really enjoyed meeting Iraqi refugee Hussam Abdul Aziz this week, as Andrew Jenner previewed his new exhibit of photographs on display at JMU.
Like any good shutterbug, Hussam Abdul Aziz always keeps his camera handy.
If I see something is very interesting or important, beautiful, I will take a picture.
Abdul Aziz has been taking pictures for years, but he's only been doing it here for a little less than one.
This picture is around Harrisonburg, and so this is very beautiful. I like this picture because I feel the sky is very close to this field.
He's describing a picture of a cornfield with the tassels silhouetted against a stunning dark cloud. It's one of his photographs that will be on display at James Madison University for the next 2 months. The exhibit, which opens today, is called How I See, A Refugee's Experience of Harrisonburg. Abdul Aziz's attention is drawn to everyday things like cornfields that many of us pay little mind.
Maybe the other people, they don't care or they don't notice that. So when I see it is beautiful for me, I take a picture and I show the people how I see.
Other photos are of things like stoplights, something I usually find more aggravating than inspiring.
Yes, Exactly. We have something like that even in Syria and Iraq, but the problem is nobody is using it. Sometimes we don't have the electric, so it doesn't work.
And sometimes they've been destroyed in some sort of fighting. The fact that our stoplights work and have little cameras on them that are supposed to make them work even better.
This is new for me. It is very beautiful because they are still working here.
Abdulaziz has never been a professional photographer. He works as a housekeeping supervisor at Massanutten Resort. Since moving here from far, far away, he's constantly learning new things from people. Through his photographs, he hopes other people can learn new things from him about the community all of us share. For WMRA News, I'm Andrew Jenner.
That exhibit is on display until April in JMU's Rube Hall. You'll find all those stories and more information at our website, WMRA.org. And we're able to bring them to you thanks to support from Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus, Janet Trentner, Joy Loving, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, and an anonymous donor. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Now, to Martha Woodruff's conversation with Jeff Ribman, who, with his wife, spent many years in New Zealand before visiting Stanton, falling in love, and deciding to renovate an enormous old home and open it as a B&B.
I think roller derby is a hopeful thing.
He earned enough money from selling plants that he paid off the mortgage on his house.
People always want to know, is that a lie or is that the truth?
I completely disassembled this Triumph TR6.
I wished I could have been a professional woman soccer player.
I'm Martha Woodruff, and this is The Spark, an exploration of interesting people doing interesting things. I was visiting the Woodrow Wilson Museum in Stanton and happened to notice that the gigantic elderly house across from it was being renovated and turned into a B&B. Not being shy, I bounded across the street, introduced myself to owner Jeff Ribman, and I asked if he'd come talk with me for The Spark. And when he did, he told me that he and his wife have been living happily in New Zealand for years. So I asked, how did you get yourselves into such a massive renovation project in Stanton, Virginia? How did I end up in this
place? Everybody says you're crazy, Jeff. We made a trip over here. It was an extended vacation. We rented an RV in Chicago and had 30 days with it. So the first thing we did is we headed down the Mississippi Trail. And then we hit Memphis and headed east from Memphis. The idea was to go ahead and stop and see my daughter, who's attending University of Tennessee in Knoxville. And from that point, we were going to go to Washington. But you can't just do it all in one day. So we split it into three. And Stanton was, I think, the second stop. And when we got here, the campground we were going to stay in was flooded. So we ended up staying at the Walmart parking lot. A very rough night. Some truck had its refrigerator going all night, decided to park right next to us, and it was quite noisy. The next morning, we get up, and we drive down Richmond Avenue towards the town and just got goosebumps when we saw the historic town. And that was it. We fell in love immediately with the town, and we started looking.
Now, wait a minute. What did Stanton have that New Zealand didn't?
Well, there's quite a few things that Stanton has. The one thing is the bed and breakfast. The seeds for that were planted probably a few years ago on my birthday when my wife took me to a bed and breakfast in New Zealand. And we saw a nice old lady there just having a grand old time running the place. She said, geez, you know, everybody just worships her house and what she does, and I want that kind of life.
Have you ever done anything remotely connected to the hospitality industry except enjoy it?
That's a very good question. And no, we have not. I think that everybody's got transferable skills. I may be somewhat of a decent cook. We'll get to experiment with that a little bit later. At least a guest will let me know. I don't know. You just take what you have. I think I'm... I was probably one of those serial entrepreneur type people as well, trying to start up this, start up that, and start up everything. So this is just in line with everything else. I've started up a bed and breakfast.
What do you like about startups?
Just watching an an idea come to fruition. And this one was really tough.
Well, let's start with the house.
Yes.
Yes.
Let's start with the house.
Tell me about the house, the age, you know, and how it was when you found
yeah,
it.
Yeah, the house was built in 1896 by the Catlett family, which was a fairly prominent family in Stanton amongst the Blue Bloods, and had changed hands probably only four times since the original owners. It's a big, I guess you would call it a mansion.
I would.
Yeah. But it was in fairly bad shape when we bought it. The railings on the second floor balcony were coming off. The roof leaked. There were tons of problems, but we decided, you know, buy it as is. We've got a vision. We're going to turn this into a very beautiful house, hopefully second to none. And we didn't know how long it would take or what we would be in for, but it was tough. It really was tough.
I want some stories, please.
Okay. Which disaster do you want to hear about?
One.
The rain in the kitchen? All right. Neither of us have ever experienced winter before. So last winter was a doozy here in the Shenandoah Valley with the polar vortex coming down. We didn't know. Nobody told us about freezing pipes, but we had all the different pipes that you can imagine in this house over the years, galvanized, copper, plastic. So I think it was during the second major freeze, almost about a year ago, that we lost our water. We didn't know why, but eventually we found it again, but it was coming through the kitchen ceiling. It was raining. So, yeah, that gave me a little bit of inspiration to change the plumbing in the entire house, which we did. You name it. We've modernized the inside as far as functional things. But the form things, which is my wife's specialty, we've kept pretty much to the era.
Were either of you carpenters or handy people or anything?
Salesmen. So, I'm a salesman. So, DIY is not in my genetic.
So have you been DIYing?
Yes. Yes.
And how's your learning curve gone?
Yes, yes. I actually took a course in plumbing. Went to the Vocational Technical Institute here in the Valley and learned a lot about plumbing, which is why we changed all the plumbing on the inside.
Did you change it or did you get somebody in?
We got somebody in. I've done some of it myself, but nothing real major. A few drains here and there, some water lines. But
probably wise.
Yeah, I'm pretty good, actually. I know what I'm doing now.
If you do say so yourself.
Yeah, I reinstalled a toilet as well. So.
And this is all new.
All
this
new.
This is all new to you.
Yes, no carpentry experience, but I've been cutting things up, carving things up, you name it. Electrical
okay.
as well.
What was the biggest surprise?
I
don't
know if I should even say it on air. Where is this going to?
I will say it.
It was an absolute shock. We got back from a trip that we took to Spain. We had booked it a while back. It was just under a year ago. I went down to the basement to do some stuff with the boiler down there, and I looked and half my chimney was gone, and there was a big hole in the basement.
I'm gaping.
Yes. It was a sinkhole. So we were quite shocked. Fortunately for us, we had taken some insurance, so it was covered, but it was quite shocking at one stage. We thought the whole house was going to go into the hole. But it's nice and reinforced now and very safe. Do not fear. We have put reinforcing bar and put grout in there, and the house is more stable and sturdier than it's ever been. We want the wow factor, yes.
Jeff Ribman and his wife Bonnie have built themselves a three-bedroom eyrie on the third floor. Berkeley House B&B is set to open, hopefully, in a couple of weeks. Pictures and a Facebook page link are on the Spark page at WMRA.org.